Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, everybody. This is Jason with a quick editorial aside. In the time that passed between the recording of this podcast and the deployment of this podcast, Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber resigned from office under the weight of the scandals that we mentioned in our report. This means that probably the shittiest thing that John Kitzhaber ever did was doing this now so that we could not take credit for pressuring him out of office. Go to hell, John Kitzhaber. So that happened. This week, America's ongoing battle with ISIS reached a new stage. Specifically, that stage where the president asked Congress if it's okay with them that he started this ongoing battle with ISIS. HuffPost congressional reporter Jen Bendery joins us to give us the skinny on our latest edition of War Making as a Legislative Farce. Meanwhile, closer to home, we have governors behaving badly. Sam Brownback wants gays to experience workplace discrimination. Scott Walker isn't sure he has the guts to talk about middle school science. And have you heard about all the nonsense that might bring about the resignation of Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber? We will run down the nonsense, because that's what we do. Finally, famous media people are leaving their famous media jobs. But did they jump or were they pushed? I'm Jason Linkins with Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter and Jen Bendery. Here's what happened first. Hey, everybody. It's another edition of So That Happened. I'm Jason Linkins, and today I am here, Avec.
Zach Carter, senior political economy reporter for the Huffington Post.
And joining us today, at long last,
Jennifer Bendery.
That's right. And what are you, Jen?
I'm a reporter.
You don't put on airs.
I don't have long titles like Zach just made up right now.
Actually, Ryan made that up for me. Our boss, Ryan.
Right.
Made up for
Did
me
Ryan not make you a title?
He said I could make up one if I wanted.
So
I
if said, you had to make up a title, what would you make up for yourself?
Let's just say this place would be called BenderyPost.com.
That's true.
Oh,
I like the ambition.
Ooh, president and CEO.
Yeah.
Jen Bendery.
Benevolent despot, Jen Bendery.
Why do you think I'm so quiet all the time? I'm
I know, because you're plotting. Yeah, exactly. Because you've got secret plans in the works. I just want, you know, if, since we're going to put it out there like that, I just want to say that I've always thought you are an extraordinary person to work with and perhaps potentially for. And I hope there's a place for me in your
Can I have a raise?
Reign of terror.
Just like not a big raise, but like a pretty big one.
Hold on. Go on, Jason.
Well, I just think you're sensible and stylish, and you're the best photobomber we have, I think, on staff. Oh, that's fair, right?
Ask Joe Biden.
Like, I take pictures of just like empty scenery and go home, and like Jen Bendery's in the mall. It's weird. It's seriously strange. I don't know how you do it.
I'm small and I move fast.
So Jen, you cover Congress, and there's been some interesting stuff happening in Congress this year. Am I right?
Some things, yeah.
What is this authorization for the use of military force business? I keep seeing it, and I just say oomph to myself.
Oomph.
And I don't know
do
what
you want to lay down a beat? Because it's like oomph, 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 right?
Yeah.
Right, there you go. Yeah.
Is there a
we're not
too?
We're not good
I have not
at
had enough
music.
Caffeine yet.
Sorry.
You guys are like flying off the chart.
That's what
Jeez.
We do.
I don't actually drink caffeine. I think it's it makes me
you
too
just
stressed
inject
out.
It straight.
Right.
Okay.
So what's up with oomph?
So an oomph is the president's request for war authorization. So the president finally, after months of lawmakers waiting, sent over his proposal for what kind of limits he wants on the war that's currently going on against the Islamic State. And there's a lot of irony in this. I mean, there's a war authorization request coming 6 months after we've already been at war.
Right.
There have been like 2,000 U.S.-led airstrikes.
There's like deadlines involved in that. He's allowed to like start some shit. And then, like, after a certain amount of time, come back and say, oh, is it okay that I did this?
Well, he's operating under a former oomph from 2001, which is really, really sweeping and lets a president do just about anything if there's any connection at all to Al-Qaeda. So they never really tightened that one up. So now Obama's saying, look, Congress, I would really like you to pass a new war authorization for me to go after ISIS, but I can already do it anyway. So it'd be great if you did, because then it looks like we're all in agreement. But the reality is I've already been taking military action for months, and I'm going to keep doing it, and I have the authority to do it anyway. But P.S., please pass a new one anyway.
So why does he actually want something to be passed? I don't quite understand. If he feels like he has legal authority to do this under the existing war authorization, what is actually the point of a new one?
Well, he wasn't going to send a new one for a while. He's been saying, I have the authority. I don't need to send a new one. But there were some people on Capitol Hill who disagree that you can use a 14-year-old OMF.
Which is kind of a change. I mean, in previously on America's ridiculous wars, everything has been kind of like rubber stamped by Congress. And they've shown really no real willingness to like jump in and like say, no, well, you know, we remember we have some constitutional authority in all this.
Well, Congress is in this place where they like to, as one senator told me this week, they like to beat their chest and say, we're the ones who control war authorization. It's the constitutional right of Congress to do this. We're the ones. We have the power. But we don't really want to do it. So Obama did this. This is Obama's war.
Yeah.
Well, and that's convenient, right? Because then, I mean, wars tend to be messy even if they go well. I mean, messy is a nice word. I mean, like lots of people die and they die horribly.
Countries get broken.
Even when the war is, quote unquote, a good war. So this, you know, by refusing to pass a new war authorization, the GOP can just say, well, wait a minute. Every bad thing that happened in this war is Obama's fault. We never approved of this, but not actually have to run the risk of avoiding the actual war if they're kind of into it.
Well, they can make the case that if they don't approve a new AOMF, that, hey, we never signed off on this war. This was Obama's war. But at the same time, they've been funding it all along. So that's a pretty weak argument. And then if you take a step further back, the AOMF that they're debating, even if they do pass it, the president still already believes he has the authority to do this. So the new AOMF, really, the only practical purpose of it is to get Congress on record in support of what we're doing. That's it. It doesn't change the parameters of what we're doing.
Okay, but you say that's the only practical purpose of it, but my impression was that the whole reason we do this, honestly, it's super farcical. But the only reason that we do this whole OMF procedure is because ostensibly the president has a vision of warfare, and then he needs to send sort of a message to the American people and to Congress, their elected representatives. These are the parameters in which I'm going to pursue this military action. These are the timelines. These are the limitations. So did this OMF not come with like a sort of like set of limitations on what can be done?
They do. But what's different now is that we have this lingering 2001 AOMF that was so sweeping that we've never had one like that before. That one, again, just said the president can use any military force he wants on any person, organization, or country connected to Al-Qaeda. And there was no expiration date on it.
Right.
So we've never had anything like that before. And so now this is the first time since then.
Can I just dig
that we've
in a
had to
bit
bring
on,
up a new one?
I mean, isn't there something that, I mean, I know the president has been saying that he has authority under that OMF from 2001, but it just strikes me as a little bit odd that an OMF written in 2001 would apply to a group like ISIS, which is ostensibly who we are fighting in Syria
didn't
and Iraq
exist
right now.
In 2000.
Yeah, which didn't exist. I mean, ISIS is an offshoot of another offshoot of Al-Qaeda that didn't come into existence until after the United States invaded Iraq. It just strikes me as very strange that this.
And what's their connection to Al-Qaeda? Last I checked, Al-Qaeda thought these guys were like way too much for
them.
They
used to. That's kind of the idea that ISIS used to be part of Al-Qaeda, and then they had a falling out because Al-Qaeda thought ISIS was too extreme.
It was like so an episode on terrorist Brady
like,
Bunch.
It does sound crazy. Like they had a falling out as terrorist groups, that one was too crazy for the other one. So they had a split. And so the White House's argument has been, well, they used to be part of Al-Qaeda.
It is a matter.
Rely on the old AOMF. Some people disagree.
Well, we did learn about what was going on in the life of bin Laden and Al-Qaeda late in his life was that bin Laden became kind of obsessed with branding and Al-Qaeda's bad brand in the Muslim world.
He wanted to disrupt the terror network.
You know what? It all sounds quite silly, but documents retrieved from his
is that true?
Pakistan redoubt.
He was worried about the image of Al-Qaeda? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was reported in the Washington Post. And that he was worried that that they had to sort of like change up their branding because the Muslim world was turning against Al-Qaeda. And obviously ISIS has no such doubts in their mind. They have a crazy plan the professed plan of what ISIS is trying to do is set up a caliphate. But if you talk to anyone who knows anything about Islam, is that none of these guys truly have the religious authority to establish a caliphate. It's all complete, like, high-flown, hallucinatory nonsense. And it also kind of reflects ISIS's weird nihilistic worldview. They just don't care. Whatever the rules will be, they don't apply to them, and they'll set them at their own terms. And so that's part of why there's been this sort of like ongoing dispute with them and Al-Qaeda. Although there's been, I've also read that there's been signs that they've been kind of warming up to each other more recently.
It sounds like a couple, like an old couple.
It is.
It's crazy.
Yeah. It's
two terrorist groups.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of
like, you're too violent for us.
Yeah.
We blew up the World Trade Center, but you guys want to behead people on camera.
You guys are that's nuts.
Too much.
Yeah. We're all of the mind that ISIS is just like gross assholes, but we're not ISIS supporters. Yeah. That'll be a different podcast.
but I think you can still be opposed to ISIS and think that there's something a little bit strange, and very uncomfortable, which I think Democrats would have pitched a fit over had George W. Bush done this, about going around saying you need authorization for a war that you've been carrying out for months already. That seems very, very weird.
You've been talking to senators. How does this break? Does this break down neatly along party lines, or is there any kind of like weirdness going on?
There's weirdness all over on this one. I mean, by and large, Republicans don't want to put any restrictions on the president. They want him to be not just this president, but the next president,
right,
to do whatever they need to do to get ISIS, like no restrictions.
So they kind of have to break from their whole like Obama's a dictator.
Yeah, this is the one
like,
time.
And be like, Obama, be a dictator.
All the ones who have trashed him for being an imperial president are now asking for him to please become
Colonel
more
Kurtz on these
imperial.
Guys. Right. Yeah.
They
yeah.
want that in this case.
I mean, and we're talking imperial is not like a sleight of hand word there. I mean, literally, go bomb people for us without any checks on your power. I mean, that is.
And we'll keep funding it.
So where does this place Democrats in a bind? I mean, imagine there are a lot of Democrats who maybe support the president's initiative just because of just pure tribalism.
So Democrats, I don't think I've heard a single person say they like the proposal as it is, which is kind of the point that, you know, it's going to get amended. It's going to go through House and Senate committees and everyone's going to make changes to it. But Democrats are concerned that it goes too far and there's too many open-ended parts to it. There's language in it that says something like, you know, we won't use ground troops except in cases that involve, you know, search and rescue ops, intel ops. That's the only time we can use ground troops. Otherwise, it's explicitly banned. And the phrase they have in there is enduring ground combat operations or defensive combat operations. So the word enduring has really ruffled people. They're like, what does that mean? Enduring. And I mean, it's almost like a philosophy 101 class on Capitol Hill right now. So many Democrats are like, what is enduring? And it's come up so many times. And some people are like, what is offensive ground troops versus defensive? And
are we talking about the ontic ground troops or the ontological ground troops?
Right.
For our Heidegger listeners out there.
So it's still like we're wrestling with sand.
Kind of. I mean, the idea was that this AOMF would come over ready to be amended. Because how are you going to bring together one group of people who thinks it should be really open-ended and the other group of people who wants it really tight? I mean, I don't know if they can even do it.
You used to be able to do that in Congress, though. There would be a series of amendments offered, and then they would vote on it, and then the bill would either pass or not pass.
Well, I think there's also this sense that if they don't do anything, the benefit for them is A, they don't have their fingerprints on this war if something goes wrong, and B, that 2001 AOMF is still out there and it continues to be the legal backing that the president is using for attacking ISIS. So
Don't they have their fingerprints on the 2001 AUMF? I mean, they approved that.
I mean,
that.
Some of them who are here.
But they can say, oh, well, Obama's taken that and run.
Yeah, I mean, that's already been out there. Obama's taking an old thing that was never intended for this.
And a lot of them aren't there.
Yeah, you have sort was 14 years ago.
You have a sort of Ned Stark problem that the people who pass sentence aren't swinging the blade. Okay, so how do you think this is? Do you have a fix on like an end game here?
I mean, it just came yesterday, so we gotta give a little time. But
come on, Jen, tell us the answer.
Yes or no?
But here, okay, you can't handle the truth.
We really, honestly, can't handle the truth. To be honest with you,
it's gonna take some hearings that are gonna get pretty intense. I think both parties will probably amend it, and Republicans control both chambers, so they ultimately control how this looks, but. I mean, I would be surprised if they pass something. What's their incentive to pass something other than their constitutional responsibility? What's their incentive as an individual member of Congress?
Statesmanship.
What is their incentive?
Other than the ostensible idea that they should have an interest in like major things that our military is doing. Sure, but who cares?
And as long as that 2001 AUMF is not touched,
it doesn't matter.
It doesn't really matter. And the White House was yelling at me earlier because I wrote a story that says the headline was literally, here's why Obama's request for war limits does nothing to limit war, and it's because of this 2001 AUMF. So this new one has all these specific, you know, limits on it for the ISIS war, but it doesn't matter because the 2001 AUMF is still out there, and that's way bigger.
Right.
So the White House says this one really does matter. When have you ever seen a president try to put parameters on his own ability to go to war? That's important, and it sets a precedent. And I'm like, well, I understand that, but that's just symbolic. It doesn't change anything legally affecting war.
Because you can just say, oh, well, sure, this is not cool under the 2015 AUMF, but under the 2001 AUMF, I can do whatever I want. So you guys stop crying.
The White House wants this new one because they want Congress to look united with what the White House is already doing. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand why, as an individual member of Congress, you would be ready to do that again, other than the fact that it's your constitutional responsibility, which is a big deal. But when has that ever carried much water in Congress? At least this Congress, the last couple of Congresses.
No. Yeah. I mean, dating back to the Iraq War, I mean, the last time, when was the last time the Senate really declared a war as their property?
The last thing we voted on was in 2003.
You guys are just blowing this thing way out of proportion. I mean, it's war. It's just mass violence.
And it's already been underway. You're 6 months. Yeah. We've already spent at least $1.3 billion.
It's also somewhere else, guys. It's not even here.
Now you're talking like a guy who's going to do well in the Hugh Hewitt show next time you're on.
Oh, I miss Hugh.
I'm sure he misses you, too. Hey there, listener of this podcast. I've got a quick little thing I'd love to chat with you about. Are you a regular So That Happened listener? Well, let us know. Send me an electronic communication with your electronic communicating devices at sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Tell us what you think of the show, what we're messing up, and who you'd like to hear more from or more about. Okay, back to the program. Okay, so we're going to jump topics now. It'll come a little bit closer to home. It's been a weird uptick this week in governors kind of cold fucking up left and right. Right? There's a long list of people, including some people who fancy themselves as contenders for higher office, doing things that they're kind of demented, to be honest. Let's start with Sam Brownback in Kansas. Okay, so
strong contender for America's most functional governor at this stage.
Right. Yeah. We need sarcasm tags on that, right? So Sam Brownback, who got back into office by the skin of his teeth after essentially decimating his state's budget, really dividing government. This week, he rescinded a longstanding state law that protected members of the LGBT community from job discrimination. Prior to this, you could not be fired from your job if your boss harbored anti-gay animus. And for whatever reason, Sam Brownback was like, nah, man, gots to fire them gays.
What?
And so he rescinded this law.
It was an executive order, right?
Yes.
Okay, well, so here's the thing. Brownback has been going around saying, you know, he's all about, like, fiscal responsibility and fiscal rectitude.
Right.
This seems like a very strange maneuver just into, like, rank bigotry. It just seems weird. I don't understand what motivates people to do this. And I feel like once the don't discriminate law is on the books, it usually is pretty hard to go out and say, no, let's actually start discriminating. Has this happened before where someone said, never mind, no, we want to go back to the gay bashing?
To be honest with you, I don't know if it's happened before. I'm sure that if we look hard enough, we can find an example, but it is weird. To say it's a pressing necessity to ensure that you can discriminate against members of the LGBT community is like kind of crazy to me, because it was like, okay, well, I mean, okay, is there like some kind of rampant epidemic of, you know,
everybody got all gay last year?
Yeah. Did gays and lesbians get tenure or something? It was just like, it doesn't make sense to me.
Jen, you know about gay stuff.
I do know about gay stuff. This is the same reason why. So this was an executive order. So that was a state level governor passed initiative, which, you know, the next governor, just like a president can do, can just be done with it. They can be like, whatever executive order the person before me did, I'm done with it. It's easy. They just get rid of them.
Sure.
So it's not a law. So that's good. That's worth noting. But this is sort of the broader part of a broader issue where Congress still can't bring itself to pass a bill that would ban workplace discrimination against gay people. They can't. And if you ask John Boehner, he will try to avoid answering your question at all costs, because he doesn't want to say on the record, you know, I don't think that LGBT people deserve new protections. And he doesn't want to say that, because I don't think he actually believes that.
Right. I don't think he believes that.
But the problem is they're too afraid to touch gay issues in the Republican Party. It's amazing how nothing ever comes up. Like when the Supreme Court ruled, was it last year or the year before, when they struck down part of the Defense of Marriage Act, there were so many statements coming out on Capitol Hill from Democrats in the House and Senate. It was a huge deal. I was watching. There were like, it was like crickets from Republicans, not even like acknowledging anything had just happened, not opposing it, not supporting it, just nothing. They just don't know how to talk about it right now, because, you know, 5 years ago, they would have put out statements. They would have said, you know, this is a disappointment, you know, gay people don't deserve special rights, something like that.
Right.
Now they're in this weird, squishy area where they're not really anti-gay as much as they used to be, but they are certainly not ready to run out with rainbow flags and support the gay community.
Right. Yeah. There's too many young Republicans who are just like, when did this become
an
issue?
Reality is a lot of them just don't feel strongly about it, but because they're elected to Congress, they're chicken shit. They're afraid to come out and say it, because then they would be starting a new trend, even if that's what a lot of them really think.
And there are, I mean, let's be very clear. There is a significant element of the GOP base that harbors very nasty feelings toward gay people.
It's small, though, and it's shrinking. I mean, it's evident being up there. You can just see it. People just don't feel strongly about this. It's not like the thing to say anymore.
But what's weird about this, I mean, what's particularly intense about this move that Brownback made in Kansas is that when people do say the anti-gay stuff, at least in a federal setting, there's some other excuse. It's, well, I believe marriage is between a man and a woman, or I want to protect religious liberty, or something else. There's some sort of ideological shield they can put in front of the bigotry to make it go down a little bit easier. Here, this is just straight up saying it's cool. It's okay to fire, harass, or not hire somebody for being gay or transgender. I mean, there's no hiding it. It's right out in the open. That's what it does.
It's an odd reactionary moment, and I think Jen's right. I think that based upon the kind of people that were electing Republicans 10, 15 years ago, there was like a need for people who probably didn't care about this issue, or even didn't want to discriminate against gays or do anything mean to them. They felt like, well, we got to pander to these people. They've been electing us. Mm. But like as the population gets older and dies, the number of people who actually harbor these kind of like this antipathy for this community goes along with it, because just younger generations, no matter what state you're in, tend to support things like marriage equality more and more as you drill down. So it's a huge demographic switch that's happening in the United States.
It's been amazing to watch it as someone who's on the Hill a lot. I mean, I remember like 5 or 6 years ago, it was commonplace for House Republican members to just go on the House floor when they have general speeches and they can talk about whatever they want and just trash gay people. Just like that was what they felt like doing. And it would happen routinely. It would be, you know, the business is done for the day, floor's open for whatever members want to talk about. They would come out and just be like, you know, it's a shame that, you know, we still allow gay people to share bathrooms with us, or, you know, just crazy stuff. And then one would leave and then the next one would come out and they would start trashing gay people. This was not.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
That long ago. This was like 6 or 7 years ago.
That's amazing. Now
that never happens, which, I mean, that's 5 or 6 years. That's not very much time, but something has happened, even in there.
Part of me suspects Brownback might be running some kind of play because he's got enough problems.
So can we point out his name is Brownback?
Yeah, John Stewart made a lot of fun with him, saying that Brownback may be worthy of Santorumizing.
I don't get it. What do you guys mean?
Can
you just,
I'm leaving this one at Lincoln's.
Yeah, no, I'm not touching it. Go watch John Stewart. Moving on, I want to talk about Scott Walker, who went to England. Okay, last week on this show, we talked about how Sabrina made the quip. Was like, what's with Republicans going to England and making fools of themselves? And I said, well, there's only been the two, Romney and Christie. We need a third for a trend piece. Here you go, Sabrina. Scott Walker went to England on what he was calling some kind of trade mission for Wisconsin, because if there's one thing that you need in England, it's cheddar cheese.
Hard to find cheddar cheese in Ireland and England. Yeah,
super, super hard. And so he really avoided the press while he was in Great Britain, probably because of people fucking up all the time. But one reporter asked him to talk about evolution, and Scott Walker said, "Oh, I don't know, I'm going to punt on that one." And I was like, you're going to punt on a seventh grade science question? I'm going to punt on algebra. 2x equals, I don't know. I don't know.
Y equals MX plus, talk to you later.
I'm going
to
punt on that Judy Blume book I read. You know, maybe God's not there for Margaret. I don't know. I'm Scott Walker. Don't know. I'm not a scholar.
Okay. Can we just be clear? Whether or not God is there for Margaret is a pretty complex theological question. So that's a tough one.
Right.
Evolution's not a tough one.
No, it's super not tough. Super not tough. But
and I'm not a scientist, man.
But here's, I remember I'm not a scientist either. You know, I'm a English major, and even I know evolution is a thing. And Miss Andrea is not, okay. So I remember a while back when Alex Perine was at Salon and not being fired by Pierre Omidyar, he wrote a thing that was like, how to tell if your Republican governor is running for president. And one of the things he said, well, they start getting shady on evolution. You know, it's just like, you know, you're Chris Christie and you know, you've been well educated and like, you know, you've had to take, you know, earth science in the ninth grade, you know, you probably had a biology class and suddenly you're like, whoa, you know, evolution, I don't know. I mean, I haven't personally witnessed a monkey transform into a human, so how can I? Who's to say about anything? I don't know what's happening on the backside of the moon. Could be all kinds of shit up there. Amusement parks for goats. I don't know. I'm not an astronaut, you know? And like, so.
Wait, Jen, I want you to talk about amusement parks for goats, because I didn't think we were going to go here. And I just kind of want to see how far we can ride with that.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Should we put an amusement park for goats on the moon?
Has this been a real thing?
We're making it a real thing, just randomly.
Okay. Yes, probably.
Boom. Done.
We'll call it Brownback Done. Amusement Park.
This is now a Huffington Post initiative leading on what's works this week. We're going to put goats on the moon and put them on roller coasters. Poor goats.
And send Sam Brownback.
That would create jobs. To be clear, that would create a lot of jobs. There's an enormous amount of manpower that would be required.
That would be required to
put goats on the moon.
The
and
only two people who would
coaster.
Need to be there would be Sam Brownback and Newt Gingrich.
That's right.
They'd be all set. They could tend to the farm.
Can we also say Newt Gingrich's? I know we're getting way off topic here, but Newt Gingrich's whole lunar colony thing, that was a pretty reasonable proposal given the other crap that Republicans have been pursuing in office recently, like what Scott Walker did this week and like what Sam Brownback did this week. I mean, going to the moon is kind of a cool idea. It's actually cool. It's a little far-fetched and maybe a little weird, but it's cool and nobody gets discriminated against.
We onto that Mars shit.
Not until
now,
we
though,
get
son.
There. Then discrimination will begin.
Right, right.
Yeah.
You know, flying under the radar on this bad, except in Oregon, flying under the radar on this bad governor is John Kitzhaber, the governor of Oregon. And this is kind of like Andrew Cuomo meets Portlandia level of corruption. Here's what's interesting about this is that, like, the cliche anytime a powerful man gets into trouble, I mean, from Chris Christie to London Whale, is that like the men fuck up and the woman gets thrown under the bus. But this is one instance where like actually like his wife is like really the troublemaker here and he's the enabler. It's just like crazy. And this is like tearing this. Okay. So his wife, Sylvia Hayes, stands accused of using her connections with the Kitzhaber administration to plump up her consulting business. She's earned something like $200,000 since she took office, just simply on like using the office to like wedge business for her. She's failed to report earnings to the IRS. She's used the Kitzhaber staff for a personal task. My favorite one being she used Kitzhaber's staff, state taxpayer staff, to sneak cats into a hotel room. Which sounds great. I mean, I have.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, wherever I travel on this earth, one of the first things I do is try to sneak cats.
I mean, as a pet owner, it is actually kind of a tricky thing for the vacations if a place is pet friendly or not. No cats, but I mean, I have a dog and it can be tricky.
Right.
So I don't know. I'm still kind of on Team Hayes here.
Okay, that's cool. Now she's broken a lot of conflict of interest laws. She's used the term first lady to promote her business. She's not, but according to ethics guidelines that are extant in Oregon, you can't do that. And prior to becoming first lady, she was involved in sort of a shady green card marriage for money. And she went in on an illegal marijuana grow real estate plot. All of which has ended. This is everything that's happened to John Kitzhaber as a result of that. He's under investigation by the state attorney general. He's under investigation by the state ethics commission. He's in a fight with the Oregonian newspaper over public records and the emails that his wife has her email account. There's an FBI investigation now, and there's a bunch of recall campaigns. And like this week,
wow,
yes, it's nuts, and it's crazy. This is flown over the radar. You know, conservatives will say, "Oh, it's the liberal media covering it up." So I'm here to put John Kitzhaber on blast, okay? Because this is like insane how corrupt this is. And he was going to resign this week, but now he looks like he's going to take the age old advice and not resign.
It is one way to keep your job is to not quit it.
Exactly.
It actually tends to work pretty well. And I guess he doesn't have like, you know.
He would be quitting because of his wife, right?
Yes.
But he didn't actually do anything.
Well, but he allowed, the idea is that fish rots in the head, he allowed all this to happen.
And he knew about all of it.
Yes, he could have put the kibosh on
this. Has he said that he knew all about it?
That's why there's multiple investigations to find out what he knew when he knew it.
Doesn't it seem like that should be the defining.
He has vowed to like end the practice of his wife trading on the his office for personal gain. And it's like, that's cool, but like most people say, I will end the corruption before you come into office. It's not like you get multiple terms in and then win re-election and be like, you know what, guys, thanks. I'm going to stop doing this shady shit now.
Is he a particularly effective or ineffective governor? I mean, was he well liked in the state before this scandal?
See, I couldn't tell you.
A lot of times, corrupt governors are actually pretty popular because corruption, like hard corruption, like you, you know, I'll give you give me this money and I'll get you that contract kind of stuff, actually gets things done sometimes. It often gets things done inefficiently.
I've seen that at the mayoral level.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to live in Providence and we had Buddy Cianci who was like connected to the mob, but he, and everybody knew it, but he still like rerouted a river through the middle of the city and everyone loved it.
Yeah.
So everyone's like, hey, he went to jail, came back out and got reelected.
Yeah. People still like him. I mean,
yeah, he has
like
spaghetti
his whole
sauce. Yeah. He has his own spaghetti sauce.
I'll say that there are a lot of these things circling around Kotabr this past election when he was reelected and he was successfully reelected. So I think it's fair to say that he's fairly popular. But the news reports out of Oregon now is that the whole state is feeling this sort of the headline said scandal fatigue. And I think that things are definitely turning for him now that this is happening.
Well, but so weird that a politician would be weirdly corrupt.
Yeah.
or attracted to somebody who was corrupt.
Who'd have thunk it? Okay, one of the things that this spawned this week was this sort of weird advice to young journalists, right? Ezra Klein was giving advice to young journalists. Felix Salmon, advice to young journalists. And this kind of spun out into this whole conversation. Is like, should you even go into journalism because it's shitty? Good. Do you have any advice to young journalists?
Well, I mean, what else are you going to do with your life? I mean, I do journalism because, I tried being a musician for several years and then I fell into journalism and it seemed pretty cool. You get to write. It's, you know, you don't have to feel like a dick. You don't have to feel like, you know, you hurt anybody with your work. I mean, I think it's cool. I think if you want to make a lot of money, you could probably pick something different. But it's cool. I mean, what else are you going to do? Do something that you like. It makes you happy. If you're into writing, just write. You know, if you'll make more money than if you like playing guitar.
Jen?
When this first started tracking all over on Twitter, I was... You know, there's so many sarcastic responses
right,
I got to have, like, because the hashtag was like advice to young journalists,
right?
You know, so it's like, oh my God.
I'll state for the record that none of us at this table today think we're any great shit that you should listen to our advice.
I do, actually.
Okay. All right.
I think all three of us are pretty
you know,
sharp.
I will say that I've spoken to a few different classes of young aspiring journalists, and every time they asked, so do you think that, you know, we should go into this field because it's falling apart and, you know, giant newspapers are laying everybody off and, you know, it's just a rough time for the industry. And again, I'm always tempted to respond to these kinds of things with sarcasm. It's just so easy to make fun of stuff. But in this case, I mean, I've told them always, yes, you have to do it because it's the best job in the world. I mean, what other job is it where it is solely your job to tell the truth?
Yeah, I mean... Look,
and you get in like really big trouble for not doing it.
You get paid to tell the truth. That's your job. And you get scrappy and a lot of people don't like you sometimes. But that's beside the point because you tell the truth and you put things out there that are important. And I can't think of anything I'd rather be doing.
You know, the thing I'll say is that like to me, you sit down and write a news story or sit down and write a column. I think that one of the things that's got to be your guide star is you got to find what it is in the outside world, your subject, the story that fascinates you, that you love, that's important, and try to shift any kind of self-love outside to the world outside you. And remember that other people are interesting. Remember that other people know shit you don't, and that it's actually really pleasurable to learn something new. And the moment the better you get at being able to take the attention off yourself and put it onto outside yourself, the person you're talking about, the subject you're talking about, the better you'll do at this job.
Yeah, and so. Approach it like you're trying to learn something new. It's awesome. I mean, I will say it's not as good as playing synthesizer in a punk band. That's actually more fun. But only like it's only like a little bit worse than that. And if anything can be almost as good as playing synthesizer in a punk band that doesn't involve you like damaging your body with exotic chemicals, then you should probably do it.
I can say it's a lot more fun than working in a bagel market.
Yeah. So
I used to do that.
We've all had. Yeah. I've delivered pizzas. it sucked. I did a lot of things that suck.
Me too.
Scanned a lot of documents.
I hope this doesn't suck. Okay, so the last thing we're going to talk about today, and this is like kind of like the meta journalism moment of this week. Some big changes at the top of news programs. Brian Williams, the handsome man who set up clips for NBC Nightly News, is taking a 6-month he's not taking anything. He's being sent on a 6-month suspension without pay from NBC News as a result of his telling tall tales about traveling in Iraq. Meanwhile, another figure that has some connection with Brian Williams, to be honest, John Stewart, is voluntarily leaving The Daily Show literally to spend more time with his family, according to him. So we have like changes at the Guard at two big journalism institutions. It's caused people to wonder how to succeed in journalism, how to avoid mistakes.
How to not lie about things that are right, easy not to lie about.
Right. So let's talk about Brian Williams first. I don't know what to say about how he ended up in this mess, because like it seems to me that he just sort of broke a simple rule, which is like, don't lie about shit when you're a newsman.
The thing is, I am kind of on Team Williams here, but only because Tom Brokaw is supposedly so enthusiastic about him being punished for this. And right. Tom Brokaw just really gets under my skin.
He's a Pecksniff, and we acknowledge that. But you understand that Brian Williams, most people out there probably have to know about this, but in case there's like four of you that don't, Brian Williams went to Iraq and he was on a helicopter, and the helicopter in front of him got hit by an RPG, and his helicopter also took maybe some fire but wasn't hit by an RPG, and then he told a lot of people that his helicopter was hit by the RPG and that he's in trouble. Okay, so that's the Brian Williams story. And he told this story multiple times, and the thing of it is that like to me the malady here is celebrity. I think that like celebrity and fame fuck you up. It's like the thing that fucks your life up. And I think that what makes a man take a perfectly great news story. Hey, I was in a helicopter. I'm in Iraq. I'm with soldiers. Helicopter in front of me took RPG fire. We all ended up on the ground, and I talked to a bunch of soldiers about the experience. Like, what is it that takes that story, which to me is enough? That's like a news story. You were there and you saw it. You could relate it. That's a great story. What compels you to like start tinkering at the edges of it, stretching the truth, putting yourself at the center of it? And I think it's just like Brian Williams, you know, at some point transformed from like a sort of like workaday journalist to a big celebrity. And once you become famous, you start to think, well, I should have good stories about me, or I'm entitled to have good stories about me. And you start telling tales out of school, and things start to warp.
But Jason, here's the thing. Brian Williams, and this is true for most new celebrities, he's only kind of famous. The only people who know who he is are old. He is on the nightly news. Nobody watches that except people over 65. So he's not even like a real celebrity. He's not a cool celebrity whose fans like, you know what new clothes to be getting and stuff.
But his celebrity is central to NBC News' business. You know, his
shoes are out of style.
He doesn't seem like the indispensable man to any of us, because like from our perspective, it's like you switch Brian Williams with Lester Holt. What's the fucking difference? Lester Holt can set up a video package just as good as Brian Williams can. But from the perspective of people like Comcast, who own NBC, Brian Williams' celebrity matters. And he figured his celebrity matters too. There apparently Brian Williams is the guy that got NBC to do this fucking live Peter Pan show. You know, the one where his daughter.
Great, yeah. Which great.
It was not great. It was not great. He wanted to host The Tonight Show. He wanted to host The Tonight Show. I was talking to Howard Feynman earlier, and like, we were like, that was the moment that someone should have been like, whoa, we should maybe fire this guy. Like, he wants to host the Tonight Show? Seriously? The guy who's the managing editor of NBC Nightly News, that's what he aspires to do?
Well,
there's trouble ahead.
Comedy, I mean, Jon Stewart is gone now. And,
no,
or
he's
not gone, but
he's gonna be gone. Yeah,
He's leaving. You know, I loved The Daily Show when I was in college, and I like it frequently now. Jen, how do you feel like that show? Because to me, when I was in college and like the Iraq War was happening, I felt like The Daily Show was the only place I could go to get somebody who was like critical of the sort of lead up to the war. And to me, he was like this really sort of formative, transformative figure in the news business, even though he sort of resisted that label. I mean, do you feel like the journalism landscape is going to change once he steps off the stage?
He's been in that job for 15 years, right?
16. Yeah.
I mean, I'm surprised he stayed that long. I think it's time to shake it up a little bit. Why not put Samantha Bee in there? Why not put a woman in there? He's done a great job. That show is one of the best, but I don't watch it anymore. Maybe I've just like grown out of it. I mean, it's a good show, but what would make me want to watch it? Change it. Do something new. You know, get someone who I can connect to that's fresh and different.
Well, and
Jon Stewart must be burned out, man. Like, he's probably wanted to do something else for a little while. And
he did talk about being restless.
And he did. Remember, he just like directed a movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
About like something about
Iran,
a camera guy in Iran or something.
Yeah. A journalist in Iran.
Yeah.
Who ended up in prison and tortured.
And it got really good reviews.
Yeah.
Good.
So, I mean, I think it makes sense to me that he would want out and that the show could probably use something to give it a boost. Not, I don't know nothing about its ratings, but something to like change it up.
You could certainly say he accomplished a whole lot at The Daily Show, not just keeping that institution alive and really transforming it from like Craig Kilborn's kind of like fake funny news to something that like, you know, did try to aspire to like, first of all, critique the media and then critique politics. From a pure like entertainment standpoint, if we want to talk about his value to the entertainment industry, you know, we talk about NCAA coaches who like former players go off to become coaches of their own. They talk about like the coaching tree.
Right.
Jon Stewart's comedy tree is astounding. He minted so many comedians out of that show. He put Stephen Colbert where he is. He put Larry Wilmore where he is. John Oliver. It's just like Steve Carell. People went on from that show to do great things. I think that there have been periods of time that have been like kind of low points at The Daily Show. I think that certainly a few years ago, The Daily Show got called out for its lack of diversity. I think they had him dead to rights at the time. But Jon Stewart and his producers clearly put a plan in and brought in more diverse voices and great voices too.
But Jen's got a point there, though. I mean, the really big spinoffs are all men, right? You know, the Colbert Report last week.
Yeah, tonight. And that's a malady throughout late night television comedy.
Who is in late night television comedy who's a woman?
There was Chelsea Handler on E, and that's literally it. And
Samantha
like,
Bee was hilarious whenever she was on comedy on The Daily Show.
Oh, she's amazing.
She was like one of my favorites, and not just because she's a woman. She's just hilarious.
Right.
And then she just disappeared.
Yeah, I mean, we...
Didn't she make fun of Sam Stein once, though, when she was...
Slammy.
Oh, yeah.
Slammy. Yeah.
Don't tell Sam, but I thought that was hilarious.
Hilarious.
Don't tell Sam. We've all made fun of Sam for that. Good God. Sam making fun of Sam Stein is like falling off a logger out here.
How exciting would that be to hear that someone like Samantha Bee was going to take over The Daily Show?
That would be
fantastic.
It would be a little bit path-breaking. It was path-breaking that Larry Wilmore got The Nightly Show, because there's also a dearth of persons of color. I mean, we had for a brief period of time. I mean, Arsenio Hall's broken in a couple times.
Yeah.
For a brief period of time on FX, W. Kamau Bell ran a show that was quite good. It would be neat to see him in this mix, in this conversation for replacing The Daily Show too, because he's got the right balance of smarts, really good comedian, and also a sense of engagement. But yeah, I mean, there is a chance now for The Daily Show to sort of mix things up for the sake of showing us a different perspective.
I feel like we'll get fewer Husker Du and Replacements references, though, because, you know, Jon Stewart was a bartender in like the indie rock scene back in the day. And I kind of always liked it.
We need new references to other things that other people can get.
No, only for white men.
Something that white dudes will not get.
All right. Thank you guys for being here. Zach Carter, Jen Bendry, it's great to have you at last. We've been asking.
Why do you keep saying at last?
Because we've asked you a bunch of times and you weren't able to come on.
Always
turn us down.
Ask
in the middle of the week when I'm on the Hill.
We're super irresponsible. It's nice. It's genuinely nice to have you
here. It was not personal at all.
I know it wasn't. Jen, it's going to be great when you're running to Huffington Post. I'm sorry.
You got to explain the brown bag joke to me, though, when we're done.
All right.
Okay. Off. Off air.
Bye. So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced and edited by Ibrahim Balki, with technical direction from Brad Shannon, and assistance from Christine Canetta, Chris Gentleviso, and Adriana Usero. I'm Jason Linkins. This week we were joined by HuffPost reporters Zach Carter and Jen Bendry. So That Happened is available on iTunes. Please check us out in the iTunes store and look for the Huffington Post's whole family of podcasts. Please subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. As always, thank you for listening. We miss you already.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.